Hampshire Public Radio News. It's now 9:06.
Support for The Exchange Friday New Hampshire News Roundup is made possible by Centrix Bank. See beyond with Centrix Bank.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. As summer starts to wind down, fall electioneering cranked up this week. That included campaign stops by U.S. Senator Jeanne Shaheen, who spoke out on issues from healthcare to U.S. policy in Iraq.
I think we should not be sending troops back into Iraq. And we have to see what the Iraqis do in terms of their internal efforts to form a more unified government.
Shaheen's Republican rivals were also busy campaigning. Jim Rubens, Bob Smith, and Scott Brown debated this week and held their own events. Here's former Senator Brown at a forum in Nashua describing his approach to Beltway partisanship.
Because what's happening in Washington right now, folks, they don't talk. They don't work together. They vote 99% of the time with their party. I was 50-50. It was the most bipartisan senator down there. One or two others.
Meanwhile, worker unrest remained a big regional story. On Tuesday, Market Basket Associates were given another ultimatum to return to work by today. And unionized employees at Fairpoint Communications picketed around northern New England. New Hampshire negotiator Glenn Beckett spoke with NHPR.
I think it's way too early to call whether it'll be a strike or not. I mean, so long as the parties are talking and the union, the IBEW and CWA are committed to staying at the bargaining table as long as it's necessary to make sure we get a fair deal for the company and for the workers.
That was New Hampshire negotiator Glenn Brackett, again with Fairpoint Communications. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange, and let's hear from you as we cover these and other stories. We're going to start with the U.S. Senate race, so let's get your take on that story. First, the primary on the Republican side that saw a lot of activity this week. Call in The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange at nhpr.org or find us on Facebook and Twitter. Our guests for this week's roundup include Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. And Dean, good to see you. Thanks for being here.
Good morning, Laura.
Also with us, Rick Stevens, Northern New England correspondent for the Associated Press. And Rick, welcome back. Good to see you, too.
Pleasure to be here.
And Kevin Landrigan is with us, longtime political reporter for the Telegraph of Nashua. And Kevin, thank you for your time. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having us, Laura.
Well, let's start with that U.S. Senate race, gentlemen, on the Republican side. Lots of activity this week, Dean. Give us a little flavor of all that went on.
Yeah, clearly, as we get closer to the primary on September 9th, we're seeing a lot of activity in this Republican Senate primary between former Senator Bob Smith, Jim Rubens, and former U.S. Senator Scott Brown. And actually, Jim Rubens was a state senator from the Upper Valley in the 90s, I believe. So the three of them have kind of been going at it. It was interesting. There was a debate last night in Conway. The Mount Washington Valley Economic Council sponsored the debate. And if you kind of look at the coverage, and the suggestion is that Scott Brown is really looking to the general election at this point, and all the polling data supports him with very comfortable leads. We'll see. You know, there'll probably be some more polling available right before the primary, but he seems to be in reasonably strong shape. And you know, one of the indicators of that is he has been, in terms of kind of where he is ideologically, he's been a lot harder to pin down. There was an exchange in the debate last night about the minimum wage, in which both Bob Smith and Jim Rubens, they oppose raising the minimum wage. I think Bob Smith opposes any idea of even a federal minimum wage. But Scott Brown said, you know, he had supported it at different times, and we need to focus on economic development. So kind of hard to pin down. And this is interesting to me because when I interviewed him about a month ago, I asked him about this criticism by conservatives that he had voted with President Obama in the U.S. Senate, I think 65% of the time. There's a figure out there that a lot of conservatives use. And he didn't back away from it. So I think he's clearly positioning himself as somewhat centrist, setting himself up for the general election, you know, sort of not hewing too closely to any particular ideological line.
Okay. And I definitely want to talk about Bob Smith and Jim Rubens and how they presented themselves in this week's campaigning. But go ahead, Rick. I know you want to jump in there.
You know, you mentioned Brown aiming at November, really sort of looking past September. And I think if you look at some of the campaigners he's had coming in, he's already had a presidential candidate, Mitt Romney. Next week he gets another one when McCain comes back. And don't forget, McCain has won two primaries in New Hampshire. He's a popular guy here.
Yeah. What do you think, Kevin?
Well, it is a delicate balancing act for Scott Brown, because at the end of the day, it's really important for him, if he's the Republican nominee, to not win on September 9, but win convincingly. And it's one of the reasons why you're seeing in this campaign, there's no question Dean's right, that his eyes are on November, but his rhetoric is about September. That's why he's run ads for 3 weeks about immigration reform, a very hard stance, very popular with social and fiscal conservatives. The same with the Affordable Care Act. He keeps talking about repealing Obamacare because that resonates with the conservative base of the party. Talking about the gas tax that Jean Shaheen flirted with or didn't flirt with, depending on where you are on the spectrum there. Those are all messages that are aimed at that hardcore fiscal, social, conservative base to see him as an acceptable alternative to Bob Smith and Jim Rubens.
Again, our number here in the exchange on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup for you to join us as we look at this U.S. Senate Republican primary, 1-800-892-6477. What jumps out at you from this primary, the different messages that these gentlemen are making as they try to present themselves to Republican primary voters? The number 1-800-892-6477. And let's not forget about the other two. Jim Rubens, Kevin Landrigan, he's presenting himself as the ideas guy in this primary.
Yeah, absolutely. And Rubens certainly had a history in the state Senate when he was there as someone who was who didn't always toe the party line, who is a social moderate, supports abortion rights, and on environmental issues has certainly been in, at least in the center, if not left of center. He had proposed a carbon tax and now denounces it. So I think he is trying to position himself as a candidate of substance and someone who, if folks want things done down in Washington with their next U.S. senator, that he'd be the one providing the most bold new ideas.
And how about Bob Smith, Dean?
Yeah, well, you know, Bob Smith is the same Bob Smith he's always been. He's an old school social conservative, and he has not deviated from that. You know, I had a chance to interview him as well several months ago, and he said, you know, what you see is what you get. I'm not going to change my position just to curry favor with voters. You know, here my general take on this particular primary, having now had a chance to observe all three of these gentlemen, is, you know, clearly I think Kevin mentions a good point that Scott Brown, those immigration ads were hitting very hard on Senator Shaheen, but he is kind of picking and choosing his issues, I think, to give himself maximum flexibility in the general. I think the other two gentlemen have had difficulty breaking into the prevailing narrative that this is really all about the general election, that it's going to be Scott Brown and Jean Shaheen, and I haven't seen any polling data to dissuade me of that particular narrative. You know, Bob Smith, you know, he may not always kind of hit the nail on the head in terms of sort of the historical or factual presentation of what he's done or what Congress has done in the past, but he really speaks to the base. When I saw him debate a few months ago, people were, you know, clapping and stamping their feet. He really kind of connects emotionally with conservatives. Jim Rubens is sort of the ideas guy. He's almost kind of like an analytic consultant when he talks, very smart, very well schooled on the issues. I did not feel that sort of gut level connection with the voters that Bob Smith had. But it all kind of seems to be moot unless we see some sort of big change in the polling numbers.
Well, there was another primary debate this week on the Republican side again, because we've got all these Democratic incumbents who are up. Rick Stevens, you covered this, a gubernatorial primary debate. What was the big theme that these three candidates talked about?
Oh, economy, economy, economy. That dominated the night, with all of them suggesting that the first and most important job of the governor is to get out and help create jobs and attract businesses, keep businesses. You know, Walt Havenstein, he's the former CEO of a defense contractor, BAE. And he has tried to establish himself as the really take charge CEO. You know, I've run budgets three times the size of the state of New Hampshire. I know what it is to run a large, complex organization. Andrew Hemingway, he's another of the Republicans seeking the nomination, and he was unabashed in his Tea Party stance of less government. And I think he answered several times, it's not the role of government to determine which businesses come to the state to determine how many jobs the state should create. He wants less government, less regulation. The outsider in this whole thing, Jonathan Smolin, also appeared at the debate and held his own against these two more established candidates. He sort of embraced his outsider status, but was also able to speak very capably about reduction of business profits tax, about fewer regulations, about you know, the job creation component of state government. The One of the other topics that came up, too, in this debate was education, both at the K through 12 and secondary level. All three candidates, not surprisingly, they support choice in schools, more charters, more ability for parents to put their kids where they think they're going to get the best education. And they also address the soaring costs of secondary education. Tuition. Jonathan Smolin thought maybe the best way to keep kids here and keep this this state vibrant, free or vastly reduced tuition.
Yeah, I saw that in your story.
Yeah,
calling for big cuts in the rate of college tuition.
Yeah, and he had sort of an interesting comment where he says we've become a state of the very old and the very young, and there's nothing in between because the kids, if they do get educated here, they leave to get jobs elsewhere.
Or, although if you look at the demographics, we're actually a middle-aged state.
Sure, but we're not that young. We're not that sweet spot demographic,
right.
You know.
Right. So, what's your take on this gubernatorial primary, Kevin Landrigan?
Well, it's certainly an interesting race to this point. I think what was most the biggest news of the week was Associated Press identified both Walt Havenstein and Andrew Hemingway as co-favorites in the primary, and certainly that's what Hemingway would want to see written in any story since, after all, Walt Havenstein is the candidate clearly of the establishment Republican Party. The Republican Governors Association supports him. Chris Christie's come up and campaigned for him twice. He's got John McCain hosting a fundraiser for him in Washington. This week, Charlie Bass, former congressman, endorses his candidacy. Andrew Hemingway's chances of winning this primary really rest on a lot of voters going to the polls September 9th, thinking that they wouldn't waste their vote on him. And his biggest problem really is fundraising. He hasn't been able to raise enough money to do a media campaign that would better introduce himself to voters. Of course, Walt Havenstein has been on TV for 3 weeks back in June. So with less than a month left, it's a much more competitive race, frankly, than I expected it would have been by this point. That's what makes it interesting. And as we've seen in New Hampshire over and over again in primaries, these last 3-plus weeks are critical.
Wow. All right. Well, coming up, we turn from politics to business, and we'll give you a market basket update. We want to hear from you, too. What's jumping out at you from this story? How is it affecting your community, your own life? Let us know. We'll talk about that coming up here on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 919. Good morning. NHPR is your source for in-depth coverage of the 2014 elections. Tune in to Morning Edition beginning Monday to hear host Rick Yanley talk with Republican candidates running in New Hampshire's two U.S. House races. We'll also have extended interviews at nhpr.org. On air and online, NHPR is your place for Granite State politics. Partly to mostly cloudy for today with some isolated showers. We'll have high temperatures from the upper 60s to the lower 70s. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and support also comes to us from Centrix Bank. See beyond with Centrix Bank, banking solutions customized to your business. Information available at centrixbank.com. I'm from Kingdom County Productions, presenting Northern Borders, starring Bruce Dern, with discussion led by director Jay Craven, August 17th, 7:30 p.m., Exeter Town Hall, kingdomcounty.org. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. It's the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange. And we turn our attention now to the ongoing market basket saga. Employees were given another ultimatum this week, told to return to work by today. Rick Stevens, what's been the response so far to that ultimatum? Obviously, it's Friday morning, so we don't know yet what they're going to do. But what do you think? What's some of the dynamic there among these workers who are having to figure it out?
It is. I think the dynamic is changing a little bit. I think there is still some real reluctance to go back to work. They love RDT. You know, the signs everywhere, Arthur T. Demoulas. But you do see a high-level guy, Deval Patrick, the governor of Massachusetts, get involved. And that changes it a little bit because he says, okay, the company and this board, they've got to make a concession. They've got to move toward the middle here. But you know what, employees? You've got to move to the middle too. Get back to work, serve the customers, serve your company, and let's see if we can find some middle ground. I thought that was pretty striking to have him come in almost like a Secretary of State sort of role and come in and try and change the discussion.
And I have heard little stories here and there of Market Basket employees finding other jobs. So at some point, Dean Spiliotis, you know, the workers find other jobs, maybe suppliers go elsewhere, people who are supplying food or milk or whatever find other customers.
customers who shop at Market Basket go to Hannaford's or wherever. So at right. some point, what happens?
Well, and that's part of the danger in terms of the devaluing of the company the longer this goes along, that at some point it becomes structurally more difficult to kind of reverse course. You know, I thought the DeVal Patrick comment was interesting because, you know, he said he had talked to both sides and that they were just working on the details and that a deal was close. So, you know, the implication was that the workers were going to get what they want, that they were going to get Arthur T. Back in back in control, although he didn't explicitly say that. So it was a little hard to kind of parse exactly what DeVal Patrick was suggesting there. You know, there have been these orders now to remove all boycotting signs and to make way for deliveries, et cetera, but, you know, one of the managers said it best. He said, that's fine. We can do all that, but we're pretty well stocked other than perishables. No one's here. So you can have all your full-time employees get all their hours. There's really not much for them to do, and there's no sign that shoppers are going to come back until they get a real strong sign from kind of the workers that that's what they should do.
Wow. Well, it's really interesting. I want to ask a couple more questions about this, but also invite you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Join us on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup as we look at this Market Basket story. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter as well. And all of you, let's go to our listeners. Tanya's in Bedford. Hi, Tanya. You're on the exchange. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Fine.
I am a loyal boycotting Market Basket customer, and I've been following the story very closely and honestly have been really disappointed in the job that the media has been doing. My Market Basket is pretty well stocked, and it doesn't matter who's back to work, and everyone is back to work except for the warehouse workers, and, you know, we're just not shopping. But one of the most interesting things that's come out of this is a Market Basket Twitter account called Market Basket for You, the number for the letter U. It was currently called the Market Basket Board of Directors Parody Account. And they've come up with the most realistic and reasonable solution to this stalemate. And this is getting absolutely no attention in the media. This could really work. And their plan is that all of the workers who have left their jobs, including the management team, will come back immediately. In exchange, the two current CEOs, Felicia Thornton and James Gooch, will be removed. A new interim CEO, who is not Arthur T. Demoulas, will be instated, and it will be somebody from current, well, pre-crisis Market Basket management.
So, Tanya, a lot going on there. Yeah, and not reported as much as it should be. What do you think, Kevin Landrigan? It's hard to follow all the ins and outs. I appreciate Tanya calling in.
Yeah, no, that was very good information, and I think they're Governor Patrick indicated that there have been a number of different proposals exchanged back and forth between both sides. It's very hard from the outside to read how really close this is to any kind of settlement, frankly. Again, especially as Dean alluded to, if the order goes out yesterday to take out all paraphernalia at the stores that make any reference to Arthur T. Demoulas, that certainly doesn't suggest that a settlement is very close at this hour. But to be sure, the biggest problem for Demoulas, frankly, is the market culture, if you will. People are creatures of habit, and
when you grocery shop,
it comes to shopping for food, once you become comfortable with an alternative store, it's
right.
very difficult for the incumbent to get you back. The longer this goes on, the more loyal Hannaford, Shaw's, Walmart, even your convenience stores become attractive alternatives to you, and you put up with maybe a little higher prices than you might have paid at Market Basket, which was why perhaps you went there in the past.
Well, one more news item on this. More than 200 New Hampshire Market Basket workers filed for unemployment benefits this week. So they're hurting, their hours are cut, and that's having another ripple effect throughout the state. You can join us at 1-800-892-6477. On the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Another story of labor unrest. Gentlemen, Rick, I'll turn to you first. Fairpoint Communications workers across Northern New England, picketed in certain places. What's happening at Fairpoint?
Well, Fairpoint, which does operate in all three of the northern New England states, in Maine and New Hampshire and Vermont, they've been without a contract for a couple of weeks now, and they're fighting over the same things that a lot of labor corporate entities fight over. It's the pension costs. It's whether it's a defined benefit or a defined contribution. It's health costs. It's in this case, it's contract workers. They've had trouble. Fairpoint bought out Verizon's operations, 2011, I think. And they've struggled since then. I think it's a reflection of the changing markets that we see. You know, a lot of people are eschewing the landlines. They don't have it anymore. So why do we need a company like this? So I think we were discussing this earlier, that the quote from the business is that, or from the company, is that the workers are working under antiquated ideals of what a contract should be, or what the business model is. Things have changed, and I think the Fairpoint company is trying to really make that point with their union.
Yeah. So, Dean, the company said, as Rick says, previous contracts reflect the, quote, monopoly environment of days gone by. Translate that a little bit for us.
Yeah, well, there was a time where everybody needed a landline because we didn't have cell phones, and we had AT&T and then the Bells and all these, you know, regional monopolies with landlines, and the market is just not there anymore. So there are these, I think it affects something like 1,700 workers in the region, and it's the typical concerns: increasing healthcare costs, pension benefits, the ability to hire out-of-state contractors without union approval. And I think, you know, Fairpoint's greatest leverage is this argument that Rick mentioned, that it's just not the same business model that it once was because the technology has changed. And in a sense, I remember when this purchase took place several years ago, that was the question: was how are they going to make this a viable business? And as Rick said, they've struggled trying to do that over the last 3-4 years.
So what happens, Kevin, if Fairpoint workers do go on strike?
Well, it certainly would be pretty chaotic and bad PR for Fairpoint Communications, and they desperately want to avoid this. So that's one of the reasons why the company has actively been negotiating with the union throughout. Because the previous 6-year contract expired on August 2nd. So it does appear that there's an environment for some kind of agreement, because both sides are actively talking now, and pickets have gone up in all three states, but there's not a lot of confrontation or a lot of hostility between the union and management right now. So hopefully something will get resolved.
Yeah. Well, another business story, Kevin, I want to turn to you on this. The New Hampshire business community lost a longtime leader. Pretty shocking story, Kevin. Gary Long, former CEO of PSNH. The family said it was due to a sudden illness. He was just 63 years old. It seems odd to think that Gary Long's not here. He was everywhere on the New Hampshire business scene.
Yeah, no question, Laura. I mean, Gary Long was not only a fixture in the business community, but in philanthropy, in politics, in all things energy and utility related. A true professional, a man of great intellect, and actually not only great energy, but was so fervently believed in the cause. That was the mark of Gary Long, essentially, was whether you agreed with him or not about how he viewed the future of energy capacity in New Hampshire. He was passionate about it. He was respectful of other people's views. I lived for 13 years in Manchester before moving to Concord about a decade ago. And Gary Long was a very powerful public presence, but his private presence was perhaps even more strong in the community, supporting charitable causes, starting organizations, serving on boards like the United Way. He was the driving force, by the way, for the creation of the 211 system, which Public Service Company New Hampshire essentially does in many states, which this provides for the human services community an emergency link if there are problems. In most states, this is funded by state government, but Gary Long was someone who saw a need and stepped in the breach, and thanks to public service, we have that right now. Again, it's rare to see someone who runs such a high-profile, very profitable business kind of look back and see what he could do for people who aren't as fortunate as he is, and that was Gary Long.
Yeah. Dean Spiliotis, real quick to you.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, whenever this is a sort of a generational change, to see someone who was able to start at a company or a corporation in the mid-70s as an assistant engineer and then dedicate a whole career to that company and end up at the top. I mean, you see that, but we see that less frequently now. But he was part of that sort of style management model. And as we've said, he left to pursue the Northern Pass. And from the news accounts of people who interacted with him, this really was a surprise, that there wasn't any sense that he was suffering from some sort of illness. So, yeah, it's certainly a loss.
Sure. Well, two health-related stories got lots of play this week in the news here in New Hampshire. And Rick Stevens, to you first. The governor and Health and Human Services Commissioner just yesterday took action against a drug called Spice. Now, what is this, Rick?
Spice is a synthetic drug that you can find it at convenience stores. It's sort of labeled as incense or something that you're just supposed to burn recreationally, but people have been ingesting it. They smoke it, and it causes problems. It's treated with the same drug, THC, that is the potent ingredient in marijuana, of course. So they declared the state of emergency to give the authorities the ability to investigate and quarantine this drug called Spice. Some of these overdoses, thankfully none fatal, but still the symptoms can be pretty extreme: paranoia, panic attacks, numbness, elevated heart rate, even in some cases seizures. I see an interesting development this morning. The Nashville Police Department, the emergency declaration focuses on one flavor, if you will, of the Spice bubblegum. I'm not sure why Governor Assen targeted just the one flavor.
I was wondering about that too.
I think they said that was the flavor associated with the overdoses. That they're not finding overdoses with the other two, which are like Green Giant and Crazy Monkey. So and maybe it's also that the bubblegum, they're concerned the bubblegum flavor may appeal more to younger individuals. But I think the main issue is just empirical. It's like that's where they're seeing the overdoses, with that flavor.
Go ahead, Rick. Yeah. Nashua.
Yeah. So Nashua this morning puts out a statement saying, okay, bubblegum is targeted, but we want to caution all you store owners out there. If you're selling any of this stuff and any of it that is illegal, such as these bath salts that have been criticized as well, we're going to be enforcing it. We're going to be looking for you, and we want you to voluntarily pull this stuff off the shelves during this emergency declaration. So I think you may see the tentacles spread a little bit and get beyond just the one flavor, if you will.
Again, our number here in the exchange, the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Find us on Facebook or Twitter if you'd like. Another health story that got some attention this week. We actually talked about this on the show on Wednesday. The same day, Kevin Landrigan, we did a show on the backyard chicken movement. State health officials announced that 11 Granite Staters had been sickened by salmonella poisoning this spring, and that most of those cases involve people handling live poultry. We're used to hearing stories about salmonella, Kevin, through, you know, undercooked chicken that somebody got at the grocery store, or some restaurant wasn't careful about washing the cutting board. This is different.
It is, and these cases have been traced to a hatchery in Ohio, interestingly enough, known as the Mountain Healthy Health Choices. This particular hatchery in Ohio has been linked to outbreaks in 2011, 2012. What happens with chickens and salmonella is the bacteria actually gets ingested into their intestines, then comes out in droppings. So people who have these chickens in their backyards for either meat or for eggs can develop the bacteria themselves by handling the chickens. What also happens with these birds is once they start preening themselves, the bacteria can actually get onto the chicken's feathers, so it can become very pervasive and a real threat to people who have these birds.
Rick, do you want to jump in there?
Well, it's just that you mentioned the backyard chickens, and this is a growing thing, and not just here in New Hampshire and in rural areas, but even in big cities, New York City, Boston, elsewhere, where people want that little slice of the farm life. They want to be able to have their fresh eggs and maybe a fresh chicken as well. So as you see these backyard coops increase in numbers, you know, it makes sense that you're going to see more cases of salmonella as well.
Well, and luckily everybody who was sick and recovered. And the moral of the story is, according to Health and Human Services, is
wash your hands.
Let's go back to our listeners. And Ray is in Manchester. Hi, Ray. You're on the exchange. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you, Laura?
Fine. Go ahead, Ray.
I was just doing some research, and the numbers that Fairpoint was putting out, and I believe it was their second quarter results, where you guys were just talking about kind of one-sided, where they're really not losing a lot of money. The old technology they keep talking about, but you don't hear about their new technology, which is Ethernet, and they've gained in the last 2 to 3 years each quarter 48.1% of new growth. They're taking in new money, and these are expensive lines that business customers pay for. And then they said that there was $4 million of loss. Well, $3 million of that was reinvested into the infrastructure, so there was really only $1 million out of like a $30 billion budget. So you really have to look at these numbers, and unless people really research this stuff, it kind of sounds one-sided. And then Frontier just signed a great contract where their sticking point was the jobs that were going to be taken out of state. And that could be the same thing with Fairpoint, where the money's there. The union doesn't want, you know, to get take all the money and the benefits, but it's kind of one-sided on what's being put out in the media.
Well, Ray, I appreciate you calling in. So with some information showing Fairpoint perhaps isn't as hurting as badly as they say it is. So I appreciate you calling in, because it is hard to get all the information out there. Thank you for the phone call, Ray. The number again is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Boy, Dean Spiliotis, what do you think about this call from Ray? It's tough to know. The company puts out one narrative, and the workers say, you know, it's not as bad as they think, and there are new business opportunities that Fairpoint may be benefiting from.
That is true, and I recall that when Fairpoint took over the Verizon infrastructure, there was talk about how they're going to need to diversify beyond just running the landlines, because, you know, the writing was already on the wall in terms of technology, and so as Ray suggested, they are kind of expanding into this business Ethernet model, having some growth there. You know, I'm not surprised to hear that, you know, that to some extent the landline argument is going to be kind of a useful bargaining chip for Fairpoint. You know, I've heard sort of mixed reports about sort of how close they are. We'll see, but I agree with Kevin. It will, if they actually strike, it may end up being chaotic.
Okay. Well, thank you again very much, Ray, for that call. Coming up, perhaps a glimmer of good news for the state's struggling loon population. We'll find out more. So keep it right here. Stay with us for more Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 939. Good morning.
On the next I & Ream show, the Friday News Roundup. Protests continue in Missouri over the shooting death of Michael Brown. Then American airstrikes and Kurdish fighters break the siege on Mount Sinjar in Iraq. And Ebola deaths in Africa surpass 1,000. All coming up on the Diane Ream show.
This morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. We'll have a partly to mostly cloudy day today with some isolated showers. High temperatures, upper 60s to lower 70s. Mostly cloudy tonight, some scattered evening showers with lows tonight from upper 40s to the mid 50s. Mostly cloudy tomorrow morning, then partly sunny in the afternoon, highs in the 70s. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and from Service Credit Union, where no dream is too big and no idea is too small. Offering business banking solutions sized to meet your needs. More at servicecu.org/business.
This is the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. You can join us with your questions and comments as we cover some of the top stories of the week. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. And Kevin Landrigan, Rick Stevens, Dean Spiliotis. Back to our listeners. Laura's waiting in Conway. Hi, Laura. Go ahead. You're on the exchange.
Hi, Laura. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure, go ahead.
I just have a question about the spice that these people have been overdosing on. I'm just confused. Is it actually meant to be ingested, or are people just doing it for the buzz or whatever because it's actually a potpourri? Is that correct?
Laura, it's a good question, and I'm sure a lot of people who have the same question. Kevin Landrigan?
It's sold and marketed as incest, and it's not. And it's advised that you not ingest this product. But as Rick pointed out pretty clearly, it's become very popular to try and smoke this substance, much like you would marijuana, and it gives a similar high as that does as well.
So it's sold as burn this, it'll make your room smell good or whatever, but then people roll it in a paper and smoke it and get
high.
Well,
interestingly enough, I the manufacturers must be aware of this because I've read that that as regulations change about what they can use in terms of ingredients, they then change the composition of the spice so they can keep marketing it. So I can't, who knows for sure, but it is interesting that they sort of keep rejiggering the formula every time some entity moves to limit it.
Rick, go ahead, or Kevin?
No. I was just going to say, and that's one of the reasons why those two other brands, Crazy Monkey and Green Giant, have been banned, because they actually have been found to have contained controlled substances in them.
Interesting. So the packaging says don't ingest this product, wink, wink, nod, nod.
Right.
Okay.
Exactly.
Well, to a more happy story, Rick Stevens, and I love this story. It's about the state's loons, the iconic water bird, and valiant efforts by folks, especially in the Lakes region, to help them. Before you talk about the latest loon count, Rick, why are these birds so important to so many people? New Hampshire people just love loons.
Oh, New Hampshire and all across the North Country. They are this, as you, the word iconic is a good word. It's sort of an identity bird. You know, they're only up here in the North Woods and on these lakes where they're gorgeous. They're these striking black and white birds with the glowing red eyes and that incredible call.
Very ghostly.
Oh, yeah.
Stretching across the lake at night.
It really sort of conjures up just an image of a bygone era. And like I said, people identify with the bird. They identify their state, their whole sort of culture with this bird. But it's also an important economic indicator. Ecological indicator. Where there are loons, there's clean water. There are good fish stocks with few pollutants. So there is a little bit of good news. Too early to say that, yay, the loons are back and we can stand down now. The Loon Preservation Committee up in Moultonboro recently concluded their census. It's only a one-hour snapshot, but it did show a little bit of progress over last year. They counted 549 adult loons during 1 hour. This was last month, July 19th. That's up from 520 adults the year before. There is also more chicks. There were 91 chicks observed this year compared with 69 chicks last year.
Oh, that's a big difference.
Yeah, and the young birds, this is the key. Harry Vogel, he's the executive director and a biologist at the Loon Preservation Committee. He says the key is getting those young ones through immaturity, where they go out to the ocean, they can spend up to 6 years out on the ocean growing, then they come back and breed. These birds are not good breeders, so you've got to have those young birds healthy coming back to the ponds, to the lakes in New Hampshire, where they can breed. The average breeding success rate is a half a bird per pair in the state per year. They've only done that, I think, twice out of the last 7 years where they've met that breeding rate. So there's still enough caution that the state has done things like change their fishing tackle law. Starting in 2016, you won't be able to have those small lead jigs, the small sinkers, because those are the ones the birds eat.
That's been an issue for a long time.
Yeah, and it kills a bird within 2 to 4 weeks. They've already had 4 deaths this year, definitely linked to lead. And Harry said, Harry Vogel says they would expect more. More details coming out probably next week when they actually have their year-long data released. So we'll be able to see more from those.
Yeah, so some preliminary good news, but there was a fair bit of hedging, right, Rick, on whether we were going to, celebrate this just yet.
Yeah, just yet.
Probably
the bird is still threatened in New Hampshire. It's protected federally, and so they just want to be cautious. They don't want the attention to fade just because the numbers are going up. We still need to be protective of this.
All right. Well, speaking of being cautious, Dean Spiliotis, I'm going to pivot to a political story that spells caution for New Hampshire lawmakers. This is the story of New Hampshire State Senator David Booten, a Republican from Hooksett, reflecting this era that we're in, Dean, where everything you do could be caught on video. So what happened to Senator Booten?
That's right. And we are talking about a video here, or a two-part video. And you and I have talked over the years about how the kind of technology, the sort of culture where you have to constantly be concerned about video surfacing has really made politicians a little bit resistant to kind of being out in the open. But this is a particular case involving David Booten, who's a District 16 Republican senator. He's being challenged in the Republican primary by a former state representative, Jane Cormier, also of Hooksett. David Booten voted in favor of the Medicaid expansion, and conservatives were unhappy with that. The conservative website Granite Rock posted a couple videos of Mr. Booten at a bar arguing with a couple of men over a treatment of women. And he's, you know, the video just shows him sitting at the bar arguing with these guys back and forth. And you can watch him online. It looks like he's had a few drinks. He's not falling down drunk by any means. He's persistent, and he also did not get in the car and drive home, which has been made clear. So, you know, other than sort of maybe being a little bit – having had a few too many drinks at a bar, there's nothing particularly unusual about this video. But, you know, everything's fair game these days, so Mr. Booten felt compelled to apologize for his behavior. And, you know, it's so – it's for better or worse, and I've had a number of – emails and contacts over the week about people asking why this is even news. You know, I think that that's sort of whoever watches it can decide for themselves. But yeah, it feeds into this culture of cell phones where, you know, you constantly have to be aware that you could be being filmed.
Yeah. Go ahead, Rick, and then Kevin.
I'd be interested in hearing from Kevin and Dean. This is my first election cycle in New Hampshire, and it seems like a state Senate race, it's getting kind of dirty already. I mean, Booten countered that he had constituents getting late night calls that appeared to show his campaign phone number. Is this the old dirty tricks just kicking in early?
Kevin?
Well, and certainly he also pointed out that it's illegal to videotape or record somebody in public without their permission. So whoever did that probably violated state law. This is certainly already a pretty down and dirty Republican primary. It shouldn't be any surprise. Granite Rock, which first posted the video, has been very critical of Booten's record in the Senate and very praiseworthy of Jane Cormier. Really, to Dean's point, with regard to what makes it news, at the end of the day, it was Senator Booten who made it news by apologizing publicly for his behavior. Once he does that, the mainstream media has an obligation to report what he's apologizing about. Until that point, it existed largely on the blogosphere, and probably that was appropriate. But in this day and age, it's no surprise it became a mainstream story.
All right. Well, here's another story that I definitely wanted to ask you about, Rick Stevens. There was a celebration in Rye yesterday marking 400 years since Captain John Smith made his expedition to our region and called it New England. It's a great story. They put up a big statue, a big monument to Captain John Smith. Fill us a little more in on the history, though, here, Rick. It's a little confusing. This region, I guess, had been called Northern Virginia before Smith called it New England. When someone says Northern Virginia to me today, I think D.C. suburbs, lots of highways, lots of malls, lots of office towers.
Well, first of all, as a student of history, I should be embarrassed to say that I didn't know that Smith was up here and had such a lasting impact and a presence. He really changed the game by coming up here and mapping the coastline, 400 years ago. So, and describing the beautiful lands and the fish and the birds and the produce that was here. It also served as the sort of the compass point for the pilgrims 6 years later who came over and. Well, as they say, the rest is history.
I see. Okay.
So he
kind of marketed this area as, it's great. It's New England. So how bad can it be? And why don't people come over?
Exactly. Yeah.
So they put up a big old monument.
Big
to
monument.
Him.
Yeah. It's a granite monument. Of course, Granite State must be a granite monument. But it's also got a bronze reproduction of Smith's original map and a compass point. So it's a lovely monument in Rye.
All right. And another story, Kevin, that came from you this week. You've been the source of so many pieces of great information for us, but this information concerned you yourself. The Telegraph of Nashua, your longtime employer, is closing the Statehouse Bureau. How come and what does that mean for you?
Well, it's a decision a lot of newspapers are making across the country to try and essentially redefine their base, protect their customers, and one of the ways in which to do that for a lot of newspapers is to eliminate Statehouse bureaus. I mean, it's reminiscent of what television did in the early 2000s when all major television networks had international bureaus all over the world, and systematically over a 4 or 5 year period, they were eliminated. You just simply, in order to control costs, eliminate the appendage on the end of the operation, and reorganize and refocus as a newspaper that primarily is serving the Nashua community and its surrounding towns.
Well, as you said, this is part of a long-term downsizing trend we've seen in newspapers. I was talking to Josh Rogers, our State House reporter, about this when you sent your news around to all of us. And he said when he first started at the State House, lots of papers had State House reporters, you know, regional papers like the Portsmouth Herald or the Keene Sentinel, you know, other papers that served particular communities of New Hampshire, but felt a need to have, you know, boots on the ground watching the legislature in Concord.
Yeah, I try not to get too nostalgic about this because I obviously intend to remain in the industry and I'm very optimistic that I will. But when I came back to New Hampshire in 1988 in the State House press room, it was not at all uncommon to have 10 to 15 people in there reporting, radio stations, television stations, newspapers, wire services. And over the last decade, I've certainly felt like one of the last of the Mohicans.
Yeah, you hear the crickets chirping
right,
there, huh?
As the number of people have been reduced steadily and steadily. Now, with my departure, there are really only two that will be there full-time, Associated Press in some fashion, and the union leader.
Well, and Kevin's too polite to answer this next question, so I'm going to ask you, Dean, what does this mean for just the quality of coverage here in New Hampshire? I mean, Kevin Landrigan, not to go overboard, Kevin, but, you know, one of the most thorough, trusted, in-depth reporters in the whole state, and we won't be able to see his stuff anymore.
Right. Well, as Kevin said, I'm hopeful and optimistic that he will stick around as well. I was very disappointed to hear this news, as I'm sure a lot of people in my line of work were, because Kevin has for decades now has provided us with so much of the kind of raw materials for what we use to do our analysis.
Right.
So I am hopeful that there will be a continuing place for him in the state. But this is a continuation of something I've seen. It's sort of a hyper-localization of news. Newspapers have decided financially that the only way to stay competitive is to be really hyper-local. So you talk only about what's going on in your community because nobody else around the state is going to be interested in covering that. So that's where your market is that allows you to transition to the web. So, you know, we're at this sort of point, sort of absurd point where, you know, Concord is too far away from Nashua to be local news, which, you know, I think is unfortunate. So, you know, I'm hoping that that trend will stop at some point. I don't know that it will. We've talked many times about how the media environment's been an upheaval for several years now, particularly print media, as they try to find other sources of revenue. So, the reporting is essential. I read a figure that said something like 165 newspapers around the country have closed their state house bureaus. So this sort of hyper-localization,
really? Wow.
Yes, this
okay.
Hyper-localization is become a real concern for people like me who, you know, use this information to do our own work and analysis.
Sure, Rick, go ahead.
Well, there's a real danger too, Dean, that now you've lost this incredible resource that spent a lot of time watching government and making sure that they were doing things right. There's an accountability component here that when you take more people out of the State House, there's only so much that the remaining reporters can do. You're going to lose the accountability. You're going to lose the oversight. We at the AP, we've committed to keeping reporters in every single State House in the country. Precisely for this reason, because we've recognized that the industry is shrinking, and some of the first places to go are the State House bureaus. But one reporter in a State House can only do so much,
right? So especially with as many lawmakers as we have here in
exactly,
New Hampshire.
Exactly.
Right. Wow. Kevin, go ahead.
You know, what I was struck by too as the news came out this week is as many people who've said such kind things about my work, which after all it's my job. That's what I should be doing, and I hope I did it well. I had as many people, not just elected officials, but a number of folks worrying about essentially the discourse about public policy and politics. Excuse me. As the point being that so much of the commentary is just that. It's not reporting. It's not providing context. It's not providing any nuance or kind of historical perspective on the news, but rather just a rant from the left or a rant from the right or even in the middle, throwing up their hands in frustration. Public officials have told me over the years that it's now to the point where most of them spend a good part of their day essentially trying to knock down gossip, innuendo, speculation that's out there. I have a very robust Twitter account. I embraced social media years ago because I understood that it's an important part of our business. And 75% of my Twitter account is spent trying to break news every day, and I hope I've done that. But the other 25% is essentially to report that, by the way, what you have seen on the web, on a blog, somewhere else, is either false or isn't quite accurate, and let me explain how.
And that's important. Well, Kevin, sure. All I'm going to say for now is you're wonderful and the very best of luck to you.
Thank you so much
for all your help over the years. Well, next week on The Exchange, guys, I will be away enjoying one last full week of summer vacation before my kids go back to school. Other capable folks will be sitting in the chair for me, and we'll be covering lots of topics, including the difficulties of two-term presidents. Also, a futuristic look at the role of robots in our lives. That's what we're up to. How about you, Rick Stevens?
We'll be diving deeply into the House races and the Senate race ahead of the primary. We'll be looking at issue-specific stories, getting all the candidates buttoned down on where they stand.
Yeah, the primary is coming up September 9th. Okay, and how about you, Dean Spiliotis? What are you going to be tracking next week?
Even though I won't be here on Friday either, I'm still going to be plugged in. We're only 3 weeks in the primary. Going to spend a lot of the week just keeping my ear to the ground and watching stuff develop, particularly on the Republican side.
Okay. All right. Well, again, thank you all very much for being here. Kevin Lindergan, I hope to see you again very soon in an excellent, fabulous position.
Thank you for your time. Thanks for having me, Laura.
All of you, thanks a lot for being here. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The senior producer is Ellen Grimm. The producer is Faith Meixel. Our engineer is Dan Colgan. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. And I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
Next week on The Exchange, we begin with our earlier conversation about Lyme disease. Then we talk with foreign correspondent H.D.S. Greenway about his decades covering regions and conflicts from the Balkans to Vietnam to Afghanistan. And later we look at presidential second terms and how President Obama's struggles are partly a reflection of our political system. Send us your thoughts by email or Facebook and join us all next week for The Exchange, every morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
Ream Show next at 10 o'clock on New Hampshire Public Radio. New Hampshire weather, partly to mostly cloudy for today with some isolated showers. High temperatures, upper 60s to lower 70s. It'll be mostly cloudy tonight with some scattered evening showers. Low temperatures tonight from upper 40s to mid 50s. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and support also comes to us from Centrix Bank. See beyond with Centrix Bank, providing complete business banking services to small to medium-sized businesses in New Hampshire. Information at centrixbank.com.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO, Concord, 89.1.
WEVS, Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH, Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN, Keene, 90.7.
WEVC, Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ, Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF, Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ, Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm. Protests continue in Ferguson, Missouri over the shooting death of unarmed teenager Michael Brown. But tensions ease there after Missouri Governor Jay Nixon puts the state highway patrol in charge of security. And the Justice Department announces a broad review of police tactics around the country. Former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton openly questions President Obama's foreign policy decisions. A federal appeals court refuses to delay its decision, striking down Virginia's ban on same-sex marriage. Voters go to the polls for primaries in three states, and the nation mourns the deaths of actors Robin Williams and Lauren Bacall. The Domestic Hour, the Friday News Roundup, after this update.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The name of the officer involved in last weekend's fatal shooting of an unarmed black teenager has been disclosed. Ferguson, Missouri Police Chief Tom Jackson announced the name.
The officer that was involved in the shooting of Michael Brown was Darren Wilson. He's been a police officer for 6 years, has had no disciplinary action taken against him. He was treated for injuries, which occurred on Saturday.
Wilson is thought to have shot 18-year-old Michael Brown to death last Saturday. There have been constant protests in the St. Louis suburb since the killing. Some protests were violent and triggered a heavy police response. This included officers who carried weapons, wore riot gear, and drove armored vehicles. The response has been criticized. Now the Missouri Highway Patrol is in charge of security in Ferguson. The officer now in charge has marched with protesters. Yesterday's demonstrations in Ferguson were peaceful. The United Nations has declared an emergency in Iraq. Conditions are dire for refugees trying to escape from Islamic State militants. The religious minority Yazidis are facing persecution. The BBC's Paul Wood reports they're asking for international help.
We've heard some terrible stories from people here. Again and again, they tell us, these are their words, they are facing a genocide at the hands of the Islamic State. Many men have told me they were snatched off the street in the town of Sinjar, a gun.